You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an old monastery in the Fox Cities has been reborn as a creative space for musicians. We'll get the story.
First, there was a hearing yesterday in the Assembly Committee on Public Benefit Reform. The hearings focused on a series of bills trying to solve the problem of homelessness in Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker included resources to battle homelessness in his proposed budget, and Republican lawmakers introduced four bills last week to address the issue, too.
Joseph Volk joins us now to talk about these proposals and yesterday's hearing. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Before we get to these new proposals, can you just spell out some of the scope of the problem of homelessness around Wisconsin?
Well, we estimate that there's approximately 20,000 people each night in the state of Wisconsin that are homeless. Interestingly enough, more than half of the people that are homeless in the state of Wisconsin are actually children. They're children whose parents have not been able to secure permanent housing, and so they don't have a place to live.
As you look at what we're hearing from the governor in his budget and then from lawmakers in the legislature, what do you see as some of the most important elements on the table here?
Well, one of our top priorities when we made recommendations to the governor was the creation of an interagency council. At the state level, there is no plan. Most other states have a plan as how to combat homelessness throughout the state. Wisconsin has none. The interagency council, which will be probably chaired by the lieutenant governor, will bring eight of the state agencies together to actually create a plan and then to implement that plan. Homeless people and homeless families, their needs and their problems touch a number of different state agencies. So bringing all of those agencies together at the same table to create that plan will be of a huge help.
And how about resources to help people dealing with homelessness now on a daily service level and at a longer term to get in a situation where they have stable housing? What is included in these proposals to do that?
Sure. Well, I've been involved in this issue for a very long time, and I can tell you that this is probably the first time in about 25 years that there's been any new resources proposed at the state level. So there's funding for emergency shelters throughout the state to help families move into permanent housing faster. There's an authorization for the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority in their rent assistance program to put homeless families and the people first. There's an increase of about $700,000 each year in the budget to help people that are leaving the state prison system that have mental health issues maintain housing. And lastly, there's a application that will be going into the federal government for a Medicaid waiver, which will allow case management services such as mental health services, homeless outreach, those kinds of things to be paid for with the Medicaid program. We estimate that this will be an increase in the state budget of somewhere between $2 and $3 million over the biennium.
I've seen a range of responses to these proposals so far. Some people enthusiastic, as you say, that anything is being done in some ways. The first time, as you said, in 25 years. Some people saying a lot of this is just a drop in the bucket, cosmetic changes that aren't going to get to root causes. What do you think about that?
Well, there certainly is real money here. That $2 to $3 million increase, by the way, it would double the current amount of dollars that are being applied by the state to this problem. I think you have to look at it in a context. It's the first time in 25 years that this issue has been addressed at the state level. Is this enough to solve the problem? No. It's a step forward. But probably more importantly, the creation of the interagency council chaired by the lieutenant governor puts us on a trajectory of hopefully making more progress in the coming years.
We're talking to Joseph Volk, executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness, looking at action coming from the governor's budget and from some state lawmakers trying to address homelessness in Wisconsin, steer more resources to it, and as he was just saying, try to come up with a plan. You talked, Joe, about kids dealing with homelessness. What kind of things could we, as a state or maybe local governments, local advocates, do to try to prevent kids ending up being homeless in the first place?
Well, that's actually one of the recommendations that, unfortunately, we haven't been able to include in the budget, and that is a prevention program. For many families who have a short interruption in their income, they may be back to work, but it could have been a sick child, a death in the family. They may have gotten behind in their rent. They may be back to work and be able to pay for their rent now, but they're being evicted because they're a month or two behind. It would make much more sense, rather than having that family lose all of its furniture, lose all of its possessions, having to go into a shelter, a child having to change schools, all of those things, for that 2 months' rent, it would make a whole lot of sense, much more sense, even on the fiscal side, to be able to reach into that family, stop that eviction, and just allow the family to proceed living where they are.
A lot of times I think when people think about homelessness, Joe, they probably think about an individual who is more or less permanently, chronically homeless, which I imagine is part of the picture. But how big a story is this, is maybe that family that's in this precarious position? They're one maybe medical bill away from homelessness.
Well, there's certainly that. There are, many people, of course, living check to check. One statistics, that I think shows the extent of the problem, especially among families, is that the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction keeps track of the number of homeless children in our school systems. And last year they chronicled 18,300 children that were attending school but yet were homeless.
And so are there more efforts, too, to help keep those kids in the same school, to help provide a stable school situation, even if that home situation isn't stable?
Yes. In fact, the federal government provides the Department of Public Instruction, which in turn provides local school districts with transportation funding, that even though the child may have had to move into a shelter and that shelter may not be in the same school, the federal government then mandates that that school district be able to transport that child to the school that they were in when they had a permanent place to live. And the reason's fairly obvious. We know that every time a child has to change schools, they lose 6 months' worth of instruction.
You also mentioned earlier a mental health treatment and allowing caseworkers to hopefully connect people who are homeless and dealing with mental illness problems, mental health problems, connect with services. How big a part of the story of homelessness in Wisconsin is that? How important a problem is that?
Well, it's certainly a problem among single adults, and we call them single adults, but there's always a family somewhere, certainly. Unfortunately, what we also see amongst families, especially amongst the children, is the trauma. I mean, if you can imagine a child being at home and the sheriff coming and having to watch all of his or her toys be packed up and moving into to a shelter, those children and those parents, for that matter, do experience a significant amount of trauma, which in many cases they need help to overcome.
If these changes happen in this budget cycle, how soon do you think you'll actually start seeing a difference for the people you work with?
Well, the budget probably won't be passed until the end of June, early July. And then these new dollars, of course, have to be sent through the various departments, many of them contracted out. But we would hope certainly by late summer or early fall, some of these new dollars and new initiatives, including the interagency council starting to meet, would hit the street and start making things better for people in the state of Wisconsin that don't have a home.
And are you worried, as we wrap up, that if this all gets passed as stated, policymakers will kind of, you know, dust off their hands and say, okay, we've done our homelessness thing, and not follow up with the future changes you'd like to see?
No, in fact, that was why one of our top recommendations was the creation of the Interagency Council on the Homeless, because that group, led by the Lieutenant Governor and including the secretaries of 8 different state departments, will continue to meet after the budget. And it is our hope that they will have a plan, that they will develop a plan and be able to measure whether the state is, in fact, meeting those plan and those goals.
We'll leave it there. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Joseph Volk, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness. He joined us today to talk about yesterday's hearing on a series of bills aimed at addressing homelessness issues in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a special music venue in the Fox Valley that's serving as a creative hub for artists from around the country.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Space travel entranced Dean Robbins as a kid. He idolized astronauts and closely followed the Gemini and Apollo missions. But despite his devotion, there was one thing he didn't know about one of his space heroes.
Growing up in the 1960s meant idolizing United States astronauts.
Hey, Apollo 8, we have a good picture.
In elementary school, we made scrapbooks of the Mercury 7 in their silver spacesuits. We cheered John Glenn's dangerous orbit around the Earth. And we cried when Apollo 1 caught fire and killed Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. In 1969, I stayed up past my bedtime to watch TV coverage of Apollo 11's moon landing. I stared in wonder at the screen, even though the image of the lunar module on the rocky surface was just an artist's rendition. Despite my fascination with the space program, I never dreamed of being an astronaut myself. Those were daredevils who had the right stuff, as author Tom Wolfe memorably put it. They were calm under pressure 200,000 miles from Earth. Me, I'm afraid of heights, among other phobias. I'm still infamous in the Madison area for climbing the steps to the high dive at the Shorewood Hill swimming pool, freaking out, and then climbing back down again. Everyone waiting behind me also had to climb down to make way for the coward. No, I couldn't see myself in a silver spacesuit. Being a hero was for the likes of John Glenn and Gus Grissom, not me. As a kid obsessing on the space program, I gave no thought to where the astronauts came from. All I cared about is that they were true blue Americans. So imagine my surprise when I learned that the great Jim Lovell is from Dairyland. He'd grown up in Milwaukee and graduated from Juneau High School. Last winter, he gave the commencement speech at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he'd been a student in the 1940s. Lovell is one of the space program's all-time heroes. He set an endurance record as the pilot of Gemini 7. He was among the first astronauts to orbit the moon in Apollo 8. And most famously, he maneuvered Apollo 13 to a successful splashdown after a near-fatal malfunction. In his UW speech, Lovell didn't brag about these amazing achievements. Instead, he urged the graduates to venture into unknown territory themselves. He compared it to searching for letters that exist outside the traditional alphabet. "The future is up to you," he said. "Just look beyond Z." It was thrilling to hear these words from a Wisconsin native. They suggest that our state isn't only a place where people make cheese. It's also a place where people go beyond Z. Just knowing that Jim Lovell is a fellow Badger gives me the courage to try extraordinary things myself. To be honest, I probably won't join the United States space program. But maybe I'll work up the nerve to jump off the high dive at the swimming pool. It'd be my own personal splashdown, and who knows what heroic feats I might accomplish after that.
Dean Robbins is a writer and author in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Maureen McCollum reports, Bet the Refuge.
At an old monastery along the Fox River in Appleton, a music mecca is budding. Inside, you won't just find people from the Fox cities. Musicians are coming from across the country to compose songs and record albums at The Refuge. Amid microphones, piles of cords, and empty guitar cases, a band is tuning their instruments, ready to get to work. Aaron Ray and the Meanwhiles have been laying down tracks for their second album in this recording studio all week.
My name's Aaron Ray. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee.
That's right. Aaron Ray McCaskill left Music City, USA to record an album in Appleton, Wisconsin. And she's not the only one doing this. Musicians from France, New York, California, and across Wisconsin are making their way to the refuge. The former retreat for the Capuchin Franciscan province of St. Joseph is turning into a getaway for all sorts of artists. They may come for the weekend or stay for a few weeks, inhabiting the tiny bedrooms that used to house monks. The mission is to give musicians or painters the peace and space they need to create.
This is definitely what first caught me about the building.
Refuge co-founder and Grammy-nominated musician Corey Chisel looks around the entryway of the chapel.
This is really the treasure. Usually most people spend time in this space just reflecting and writing.
The chapel, with its high ceilings and massive windows, doubles as a concert venue for the community and a second recording studio.
I really love natural-sounding recordings, and I've made a lot of very sterile recordings where they literally soundproof everything. But the reality is, as human beings, is we don't exist in that space. We live in a natural world where if a couple songbirds bleed into the mix of a song, I'm completely okay with that sort of collaboration.
The idea of getting away from certain aspects of the music industry is part of the reason Chisel returned to his hometown of Appleton and led him to co-found The Refuge. For years, Chisel was living the life so many musicians dream of. He was signed to a label and living in Nashville. Corey Chisel and the Wandering Sons toured the world with musicians like Norah Jones, and he played music with people he cared about. Something was missing. Chisel's focus was on creating hit records. He felt uninspired. Refuge co-founder Adriel Denae also felt lost. She's Chisel's musical collaborator and partner.
You know, after a decade and a half in the more traditional music industry and environment, it had grown so depleting to me. It's like you're searching and lunging and like leaping towards these things that you're not really even quite sure you want or whether they're going to be satisfying in any sort of soulful way. You just are doing them because it's how it goes and what you're supposed to do.
What happened next was a series of serendipitous events. Denae and Chisel were traveling to Appleton more often for the Mile of Music, an annual Americana festival that Chisel co-founded. Meanwhile, the former monastery was being run by an environmental group, and they needed a leader. And then, Denae and Chisel became first-time parents. So they took a risk, moved into the monastery, and named it The Refuge.
It definitely initially got a lot of people's attention to be like, either they've lost their mind or they've really found a home. So we've had every friend that we get that visits winds up coming back for a project.
Chisel and Denae created The Refuge as a nonprofit to give musicians a space to create. They've tapped into their industry connections for guidance. The Refuge's curation board is made up of nationally known musicians like Roseanne Cash, Patrick Carney of the Black Keys, and the Smashing Pumpkins' Jimmy Chamberlain. Chisel says dozens of musicians have recorded at The Refuge over the last couple years. Each of them is in a different phase of their career. Take John Wheelock of the band J Council. He's a regular around The Refuge.
It's been so long since you've been gone.
Wheelock was crowned The Refuge's first artist in residence. That means the Kakana native got the space and production team needed to record an album for free.
It allowed us to take our time and make sure it was right and not so much of a rush project.
This is unusual for musicians, since renting a studio and paying for a sound engineer can cost hundreds of dollars per day for emerging artists. As Wheelock begins to navigate the music industry, being an artist in residence also means he'll get advice on his career. And in return, he'll find a way to give back to future artists in residence. This is one way The Refuge is impacting musicians, but it's also supporting other artists in the community. Just past the kitchen in the lower level of The Refuge, classical music pours out of Frank Anderson's studio. The walls are covered in paintings he did of Wisconsin-based musicians.
This is Dave Dudley. He's the father of truck driving music. He sold 3 million records. His entire career, he lived in Wisconsin. He's a Polish boy from Stevens Point. He died here.
To say Anderson is obsessed with all things Wisconsin is an understatement. He loves teaching people about Wisconsin inventions and the famous people that hail from the state.
He's a stop-motion director, and lately he's been working on national TV spots and commercials. Throughout his decades-long career, Anderson's work has always pulled him out of Appleton. But for the first time, he's able to work in the place he loves.
Corey, he got the scene going, basically. He wants to corral all the local talent, for lack of a better word, in one place.
Anderson thinks it's a big step for the region. He wants people to know that there's more to Wisconsin than cheese, cows, and barns.
When a red barn collapses, I applaud, because I'm sick of that. That's not what we are. We are great, innovative talent, imaginative people, and hopefully we'll stay here.
Retaining and attracting talent to the region is something Adrienne Palm thinks a lot about. She's the director of Pulse Young Professionals Network with the Fox Cities Chamber of Commerce. She says more local businesses are starting to see the value in investing in music and the arts. Plus, Palm says events like the Mile of Music and places like the Refuge bring outsiders to the area.
They're creating people who can be advocates for our community, who can speak to how unique and interesting and valuable the Fox Cities are.
Members of the community and corporate sponsors have already chipped in to help finance the Refuge and its artists. Corey Chisel says he hopes the community will grow to take pride in caring for this artistic space.
Why it matters is because at the end of things, the only evidence of a society at all is often their songs and their art. I mean, how do we know about the Egyptians? How do we know about the Greeks? Through stories, through songs, through paintings. And it's really the way, in the end, I think that we leave a map to who we were and what we were about.
And for Chisel and Danae, it's creating a stronger community, one song at a time. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Teacher pay is one of many contentious issues in the world of education. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker's collective bargaining reforms have changed the landscape when it comes to teachers and compensation.
A Milwaukee Journal Sentinel special report shows that since Act 10, school districts are taking a more private sector approach to paying teachers that includes administrators linking teacher pay to skill and performance instead of seniority.
Our next guest and his colleagues researched the impact of this kind of merit pay and found that, if done right, it can have a positive impact on student performance. Matthew Springer joins us now. He's an assistant professor of public policy and education at Vanderbilt University. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Well, Rob, thank you for having me on today.
We'll dig into the details and finer points, but big picture, what were your main findings when it comes to merit pay for teachers?
Well, our main finding overall, and this is looking across the known 44 studies that we were able to locate, is really that merit pay had a significant impact on student test scores. When we're looking at all the studies, including studies outside the United States, we equated that the test score gain was roughly equivalent to about 4 additional weeks of learning. When we look at studies just within the United States, we see a gain of about 3 additional weeks of learning.
Now let's get into some of the details. Now, what do we mean by merit pay? How does that tend to work in a school district?
Yeah, so in this instance, we're considering a merit pay program, any program that rewards a teacher based upon their performance, and that would be based upon compensation.
And this is where it can get kind of controversial. What kind of metrics are used when evaluating teachers to decide their pay? What kind of things do you see out there when it comes to implementing this?
Yeah, so we're seeing programs that are using kind of a more holistic approach these days. That includes a student test score measure. It may include multiple classroom observations. It may include feedback from parents or students, as well as some additional metrics at the school level or potentially at the team level, like a grade level team or possibly a departmental team.
And how do you tease out the impact of merit pay in particular from one school district to the next? Merit pay could be an indicator of wider attitudes or changes or innovations within a district or commitment to spending, things like that. It might be a marker, maybe, and not the cause of the changes you see.
Yeah, so in this particular study, which is actually called a meta-analysis, mm-hmm. and what a meta-analysis is a quantitative way to combine the different effects across all the known studies that we're able to locate. And so we focus exclusively on student test scores, and this is largely based because of the theory of incentive pay within the literature. And one of the theories suggests that there's going to be a motivational effect, and that is teachers are going to approach their job differently, they may try different instructional strategies, and as a result, test scores may increase. The second theory that we really look at within the literature is what we call the compositional effect, and that is those teachers who are most likely to be rewarded under a particular merit pay system are those who are most likely to stay within the profession, as well as those who are most likely to be recruited in. We would also assume that if a teacher does not receive a bonus, it may send a strong signal, as in they need to try different instructional strategies, improve their performance, or that they might exit the system altogether. And in this particular study, we focused not on that compositional component, but we focused solely on the student test score outcomes.
And did you try to tease out the causality here? Merit pay comes into effect. It changes the teacher performance. Ultimately, test scores increase. What could be happening, you know, in a classroom that is making that connection?
Yeah, so I think in the different instances, we may see that teachers are trying the different instructional practices. They may be collaborating more often together. They may be more likely to pursue a different type of professional development or instructional coaching that's going to improve their practice. And to get to the cause question, right, we would hope we look at what we believe are the most rigorous studies using the rigorous research design that is going to let us infer causality. And in those studies, we see that the effect persists. So when we begin to rank the studies by the quality of their research design, we still see that there's that relationship between the merit pay program and those test score gains.
Talking to Matthew Springer from Vanderbilt University, looking at research he and his colleagues did on the impact of merit pay. Merit pay done right can lead to, it looks like, a decent increases in test scores for kids. And I use that phrase, if done right, Matthew. You and your colleagues found differences between a couple different ways of approaching merit pay for teachers. What are the differences and what seems to work better?
We actually found that incentive pay systems that were based on some sort of team component, and that may be a reward based upon a grade level team, as I said earlier, those tended to be more effective. But I also want to highlight one important note here, and that is that, you know, we're based on relatively few studies when we get down to the different program features and the design of these programs. I'll also say anecdotally that, you know, merit pay has had a very rocky history within the U.S. public education system over many, many decades. And we do know that for these programs to be implemented effectively, we need broad-based stakeholder buy-in. We need the teacher associations working together with the school district personnel, researchers evaluating the program to see what's working, what might not be working, and how to make things better. And oftentimes, these programs have been short-lived because they're implemented from a top-down mandate where a superintendent of a school system says, I want a merit pay program, let's implement it. But we also know nationally that the turnover rate of superintendents is around 2.5 years, and the programs tend to disappear as they move on.
Yeah, one objection, you mentioned some of the controversy around merit pay. One objection is that what happens in a classroom from year to year may depend on variables beyond a teacher's control. One teacher or one grade might have more difficult students, say, students coming in with learning problems that are beyond a teacher's control in some way. How does that get compensated for in designing a merit pay system?
Yes, and these are really important factors that we begin to take into consideration. And why I say we can't just pinpoint one type of incentive pay system that's going to work everywhere. We really have to be responsive to what the teacher labor market's like, what the working conditions are like, and what the realities of a particular school may be. And we do have developments in terms of measuring teacher value added, in terms of classroom observation protocols, in terms of alternative measures that we can all bring together into a single package in order that we can reduce some of these other outside influences on the way in which we evaluate teachers.
And then some object, and there's almost a resistance movement to standardized testing in the country, the idea being that if we evaluate schools, districts, and teachers in particular on standardized test scores, then teachers will be forced to teach to the test, is the phrase, that maybe we're not teaching kids valuable skills, we're teaching them to be better at taking standardized tests.
Absolutely, Rob. I think this is an important point that everyone takes into consideration, and that is, you know, the results from a standardized test occur at one point in time throughout a 180-day academic year. And this is really why when I'm on more of the program development side and working with policymakers and practitioners, I really think it's important that we use multiple measures in order to evaluate teacher performance and not just design systems that are solely based upon a test score. In fact, in some of my earlier work in Nashville, Tennessee, as well as Round Rock, Texas, is we based bonuses in an experimental setting solely on a value-added measure of teacher performance. And in those instances, we did not find a positive effect. And so I think that's important that we take these lessons into consideration.
Yeah, value-added is a catchphrase I keep seeing a lot when it comes to education. Talk about what that means and how it fits into the merit pay issue.
Really, generally, what we're talking about here is we want to see what a teacher's contribution is to student learning beyond what we would have expected that student's gains to be. If a student gains beyond what we would have expected them to gain, we consider that to be added value that we attribute to a teacher.
So are you talking just in terms of student test scores then, the teacher's impact on that, or other measures as well when it comes to value added?
Yeah, typically when we're talking about value added, we're talking about a test score measure, yes.
Do you look at things like grades or passing into the next level or other things beyond standardized test score when measuring that?
I think these are all important measures to take into consideration. I think grades can oftentimes be very subjective, and a teacher may have direct control over what grades a student receives, and as a result, they can kind of dictate whether they're going to receive a bonus or not. However, if we develop independent, maybe student learning objectives, or we have outside observers come in and observe a teacher's classroom 5, 7, 10 times a year, these are more likely going to be not only measures that would be valuable from a evaluation standpoint, but also from a formative standpoint. How might a teacher approach their job differently in order to improve their practice within the classroom?
This has been a controversial issue, merit pay, here in the United States. You also look around the world for points of comparison. What kind of lessons can we learn from what other countries have done in their educational systems?
Yeah, so for the studies that occur outside the United States, most of which occur within developing nations, it is difficult to equate the context, right? In the United States, we have, at least from the past, with No Child Left Behind, we had stronger accountability systems. There's different pressures within the system. But in terms of lessons learned, particularly from the research, and you touched upon some of this, Rob, is what are these unintended consequences of a merit pay system? And that may be a teacher teaching to the test, focusing exclusively on the test score. That may be systematic behavior, opportunistic behavior in terms of systematic cheating on the test in order to increase the likelihood of receiving a bonus. So while our general finding is that, yes, we do seem to suggest that within the United States, there's about 3 additional weeks of learning for those students being taught by a teacher who is eligible for a merit pay system, I also want to make sure everyone's aware that a lot of thought does need to go into the design, the implementation, and the monitoring of these systems to avoid these unintended outcomes.
We'll talk about that a little more as we talk to Matthew Springer, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Education at Vanderbilt University. We're looking at a study he co-authored that found that teacher pay based on performance, merit pay, can be good for student performance.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of teacher merit pay? Are you a teacher or school administrator yourself? Tell us if you think paying teachers based on test scores or other metrics is ultimately good for student achievements and teacher retention. Do you think that teacher pay should be based on seniority and experience? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We continue our conversation now with Matthew Springer, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Education at Vanderbilt University. We're looking at a report that says paying teachers based on performance can be good for student test scores.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that taking a private sector approach like paying teachers based on student achievement is good for education? Do you have a student that attends a school that uses a merit pay scale, and do you think it helps student achievement? If you're a teacher or a school administrator, tell us how you think merit pay affects public school employees. You can call us at 800-642-1234.
And we'll go to our callers. Catherine joins us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Yes, I've been a teacher for over 16 years, and I've been through many different times of types of payment systems. And with the merit pay, my fear is that, and I've seen it, that, you know, people who are friends with administrators tend to receive other types of benefits in the school system. And with merit pay, just as you say, teachers may possibly give students better grades and scores. That also happens with the staff, where if you're friends with administrators, you perform better on paper.
Catherine, thanks for the call. And Matthew, that's a concern I've heard raised, that this could be arbitrary. An administrator could give better merit pay evaluations to teachers they like than those they don't.
I think that's absolutely right. It could happen. But I also want to take a broader perspective to answer this particular question, and that's during the 2012-13 school year, and this is the most recent year for which we have national data on school spending. We know that public schools in the United States spent roughly $210 billion on teacher salaries. That accounts to about 60% of all operational expenditures. The primary determinants in which teachers were paid was based upon years of experience and degree held. Yet we know that years of experience and degree held has not a very strong correlation, almost no correlation, to student outcomes. And if in a system where we're going to spend that much money, there might be a more effective way. And while I'm very concerned about these issues of gaming the system or ways in which cheating may occur to favor somebody over another person, I also think that we can find a more effective way to allocate this much money.
Thanks for your call. We'll go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I think we can draw it out. Wisconsin, I'm a state employee. I'm an attorney, and we've gone to merit pay in the state. And what happens with merit pay when you don't have, for example, union bargain contracts is what's called unfunded payment. For example, they have a ladder for progression of attorneys based on performance, but they don't fund it, so no one gets any pay increase. As a result, in this state, very critical positions, such as assistant district attorneys, are resigning en masse because they're not getting adequate pay to compensate for their skill levels. They stay a couple of years, and they go into private practice. Especially with the restrictions that Scott Walker has placed on school districts in terms of raising revenue, when you have an unfunded mandate, you theoretically have merit pay, but in fact you have very little increase in pay at all, which results in a race to the bottom. And I think people are seeing that people getting education degrees in Wisconsin are increasingly going to Minnesota, where there's better pay and better benefits.
Jim, thanks for the call. Matthew, is this a concern in schools that a merit pay structure might be in place, but the money isn't necessarily there to back it up?
Yes, we have to make sure the money's there. I mean, if a program is going to be effective or even have a chance of being effective, that money needs to be present. And unless we can guarantee the money is going to be there in the long term, you would think automatically that the power of that incentive is going to be taken away.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Matthew Springer from Vanderbilt University, looking at his research on merit pay for teachers, merit pay in schools, the impact it has on student performance. If done right, he says the research shows it actually has a pretty good impact on student performance. And Matthew, you've mentioned earlier, you know, that supervisor who comes in or the administrator comes in and wants to bring in merit pay because it's the thing to do and may be there for a couple of years and then leave, and then the system kind of languishes. You've talked about a lot of pitfalls that can go wrong. So what is the way for a district, a system, to come in and do it right from the beginning?
It's a fantastic question, Rob. And I think to do it right from the beginning, you need two things. One is you need the resources. And you need to put those resources in place for the long term. And two, you need a comprehensive package. It just can't be an add-on to an existing compensation system. We really need to work with a broad set of stakeholders and put a comprehensive reform in place and then give it plenty of time to take place. I think in that instance, and if it's well planned out, you would see not only what we consider that motivational effect, but you also see that compositional effect. And no longer will we see those teachers leaving Wisconsin for Minnesota.
Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Manitowish Waters. Kay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kay?
Well, I wanted to bring, I'm a retired teacher. I taught for 30 years, both in Mississippi and Wisconsin. And I found the most important thing for me as a teacher to be an effective and really good teacher was, one, I became a National Board Certified Teacher, and two, furthering my education among other great educators. And I didn't hear that in your formula for merit pay.
Furthering your education among other, what did you mean by that, Kay?
Well, when I did my national board, we had a program where we got together with really highly motivated history teachers across the state, and that working together with people from outside your district as well as inside your district was incredible. But also the national board certification process was incredible in understanding what teaching was all about and what new ideas you could bring into the classroom.
Okay, thanks a lot for bringing those up, Matthew. You talked about that master's degree as a source of the pay scale maybe not being a great indicator of student performance. What about things like these other certifications or getting trained by highly respected, motivated teachers from other districts?
Yes, and I think the prior research has shown that the national board is associated with more effective teachers in certain instances. And I think it's fantastic for teachers to pursue. The one concern I do have is that oftentimes school districts will provide teachers a permanent pay bump for earning those types of certifications. And I think really to be most efficient with limited dollars in times of scarce resources, as well as the power of these incentive programs, would not to be make it a permanent pay bump. I also, though, wholeheartedly agree that these, when I'm talking about a comprehensive program, is you also need the professional learning opportunities packaged in with these systems. It's just not compensation alone that's going to change it. We also want to make sure that we have the professional development and learning opportunities available to teachers as well.
Kay, thanks for the call. Matthew, as we start to wind down, you mentioned that this has been a controversial issue for a number of years here, but do we see the trend turning toward merit pay in more and more schools?
I do see more and more schools implementing merit pay programs, and I think since about 2002, the federal government has funded well over $2 billion worth of incentive pay programs. I'm hoping, though, that we can take a much more systematic approach, a much more disciplined approach, a much more principled approach into putting these programs into place. And Rob, the way, as we close out here, the way I really want to put it is let's imagine for the moment that you weren't the talk show host. Let's imagine for the moment that you're the innovator and you develop the next it thing. And you came to a meeting with a bunch of potential funders. If you told those funders that the way you wanted to compensate those employees, the individuals in your firm that hold really the key to success in a way that has nothing to do with how well the it thing is produced or how well your firm outcomes are going to be determined, I think most of those people would laugh. And I think right now the way in which we compensate employees in the education system doesn't have enough to do with the outcomes we're trying to produce. And we really need to move to a system where our best and brightest educators receive a six-figure salary. And unfortunately, with a single salary schedule in place today, we'll never get there.
We'll leave it there. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me and have a great day.
We've been talking to Matthew Springer, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Education at Vanderbilt University.